This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Man Out of Time, displaced protagonists in speculative fiction.
So this week in particular, we're looking at characters in speculative fiction who have been removed from their place of origin, either in time, in universe, etc., and have been inserted into a new and completely alien environment to them.
Yeah, and this can come about in several different ways, but we're sort of basing it initially off the old story by Washington Irving, who wrote The Headless Horseman of Sleepy Hollow also. He wrote a story which is really weird called Rip Van Winkle, which is set during the time, well, it's just set but just before the American Civil War and continues to just after the American Civil War. And the character is this odd little Dutch guy who's very kindly, but just he's quite lazy, doesn't get a lot done, doesn't accomplish very much. And one day he helps someone carry something up a mountain, which seems very out of character because, let's face it, he's quite lazy. And when he gets up there, he finds that the source of the thunderous noise he's been hearing is a bunch of odd little men with ale who are knocking down ninepins. I told you it was a weird story.
Okay.
Yeah, instead of asking them any questions like, what are you, for example, he helps himself to some of their ale and falls asleep.
Right, as you do. That's a good idea.
When he wakes up, he's surprised to find that the stock of his musket, being wood, has rotted away and that the barrels have rusted, and he can't find his dog anywhere. His dog seems to be long gone. Anyway, he heads off on down the mountain and is really surprised to find that the village is changed somewhat. There seem to be more houses there. There are less people. And someone turns to him and says, which way did you vote? And Rip Van Winkle says, what are you talking about? I've never voted in my life. I'm a loyal subject of His Majesty King George III, which nearly gets him into a fight.
Right.
And of course, the entire American Civil War has taken place while he's been up there sleeping away on the mountain, having had the fairy ale. And everything's changed. The entire world is completely different. And the story ends on a really odd note, as in basically his grown-up daughter takes him in and he just goes back to being a lazy sod. So it's not really a morality tale or anything. But that odd sort of being removed from time and just plunked back in years later when you can't change or affect anything when all the power's been taken away from you is sort of what we're looking at.
Yeah. It is a particular thing because we have a lot of stories where one of the main conflicts is a character has been placed into a different time and has to acclimatize very quickly whilst dealing with other situations. And very often they have to disguise the fact that they're from a different time. Usually if they go into the past, they have to disguise the fact they're from a different time, because otherwise they'll be called witches. And if they go into the future, they just tend to get teased.
No, I don't know. I've read quite a few where it's not sensible for anyone to know they're from the past in the future either.
Yeah.
And they get into a lot of trouble. Diana Wynne Jones, The Homeward Bounders, for example.
Yeah.
She basically, the girl in the main character, gets pulled out of the middle of the Blitz and ends up a few hundred years in the future. That one has a happy ending.
It's not a fun place to be, though.
No, it's not. But there are also, going back to sort of the Rip Van Winkle idea, that's obviously based off of the old, more Celtic fairy tales, where someone might decide to sleep next to a fairy mound at night, you know, if they're really stupid.
Yeah.
Or they might follow fairy music down into the earth. And when they're finally released, they find 100 years has gone past and everybody they knew is dead.
Which isn't a very fun thing to discover.
Which is really disturbing. It's that sense of you're in one place in your life. Usually these characters that get taken are extremely good. They're competent. They're either really good looking, they're very talented musicians. So, you know, they're on their way up in the world. And your star in ascendancy and suddenly to have the world just completely change around you.
Yeah.
You get the same sense of dislocation just reading fairy tales, I think.
Mm. Yeah, no, I get exactly what you mean. And it's an odd thing because it's not a really a form of punishment necessarily. Quite often when tales like this, when you get the fairies involved, you said it first, so I don't feel guilty about saying it. It's about them sort of having to learn a hard lesson. Whereas more often than not, in the case of the being taken out of their time, it just sort of happens. In fact, it's often a sort of reward thing. Oh, you're a fantastic musician. Let's bring you into fairy. You perform and then you get back and everyone you know and love is dead.
Yeah, there's no malice really involved, but there's no consideration for the different times either.
No.
So it really is taking a step away from your own world. A couple of things that have done this quite well, weirdly, with zombies. There's 28 days later where the main character wakes up in hospital and sort of goes outside, and London is not so much in ruins, but it's deserted. Everybody's gone. And there are these weird infected people. And then it's reprised again at the beginning of The Walking Dead. The officer Rick Grimes gets shot and goes into a coma. And when he wakes up, everybody's gone, you know? Everything's weird and different. And obviously, there are the Walking Dead. And he's completely abandoned. So once again, he's been forcibly removed from the goings on of his own world. There's a connecting piece that just is missing. He's woken up to find the world's ended.
Which again isn't a particularly fun thing to discover. It's the whole the way they do it in The Walking Dead is actually quite interesting, because we are only following Rick. We don't get any of the back of what happened at all. We see him get shot, and then he's in the hospital, and he wakes up.
Yeah, he is our access point. And is for several episodes until they start branching out with the characters. But once again, you get no backstory. You don't know how it happened, and it's actually quite clever as a narrative vehicle to remove the traditional running, screaming, everyone getting infected zombie movie type feel that can be a bit hammy now, I think.
No, I agree. But it does create this very disjointedness because we get a shot of sort of the world before. And it's the world we recognize and the benign kind of issues that they're dealing with and things along those lines. And then very suddenly we're thrown into this apocalypse in the same time that he is, with no explanation, with no understanding of where everyone has gone. I really, really like the way it's done.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I quite like the way it was done in 28 Days Later as well, and I'm not sure whether they were sort of riffing off that a little bit, which probably they were, but it almost
Well, I
doesn't
mean, it
matter
was
because.
The Walking Dead was a comic book series
Yeah.
originally.
I think the thing is they're both sort of a bit contemporary with each other, so it would be difficult to say. I think technically 28 Days Later came first, but I don't think it matters. It's just really interesting. You take the main character out of the action, have the action all happen, and then put them back on stage and say, deal with it.
It is because it's not only throwing them into a different world, it's throwing them into a different timeline, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
In that they are thrown into the middle of a story. The inciting incident has already happened. They don't know what's going on. They just have been everything they know and understand about the world has been removed from them. The very fabric through which they understand reality, the way that they process information, it's all gone.
Yeah, definitely. It is the ultimate survival narrative in a way, isn't it? Not because of the zombies, just because of the we've changed the entire set of rules that you've been living your life by, and you don't know what the new rules are, and you have to learn really fast, and one mistake could cost you everything.
Which is not a fun prospect.
Except for us, the viewers, obviously.
Clearly it's entertaining for us, but I don't envy Rick Grimes. He's had a tough time of it.
And then you think you can come at it from a slightly different angle because obviously his wife thinks he's dead as well. So things have happened there. If you haven't seen The Walking Dead, I have to say honestly, where are you? Where have you been kind of thing. But his wife is, because he's dead, the world's gone to hell and you don't know if you're going to die tomorrow. She's sort of fallen into having an affair with his best friend. And then, of course, he comes back and it's like, surprise, oh, I'm so glad to see you. Oh, my God. And it goes on from there. And, yeah, okay, there's a sort of EastEnders-esque drama going on. But it's very realistic under the circumstances.
It is. And it adds another texture to it as well. Because, again, it adds that everything you knew is gone. And there are no rules all of a sudden.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is that Rick comes into it later in the game than Shane, the guy who is having an affair with his wife. And Rick is still, at his heart, a very moral person. Whereas Shane has started to sort of descend into survival mode, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think the thing with Shane is he's sort of like a functional psychopath, isn't he?
Yeah, but the thing is, like, he's definitely not a bad person. But I don't think he is a functional psychopath. I think he does feel, I think he cares. But I think he basically is the first one to make that decision to just do what he has to survive.
He certainly goes from, let's hold on to our humanity, to, you know, certain things are now luxuries very, very quickly. Far quicker than any of the other characters.
Yeah, no, I do agree. He does do that. But when you consider how the rest of the characters develop from then, by the end, Rick is definitely showing some very Shane-like behaviours.
Yeah. And I think that's a deliberate closing loop, isn't it?
Yeah. At which point, you know, one must ask themselves, was what was happening? Actually, Rick came into this apocalyptic world, still holding onto the sensibilities of the life before. Whereas Shane had already been living in it. He developed within that world. He was actually more equipped for it.
I think it's more a case of they might have ended up on completely the same page, except that obviously they removed Rick from the action for a bit. And Shane lived through what would basically be the rising.
Mm-hmm.
And the fall of humanity, the fall of society, the fall of all the rules and things that they would have known. And would have, you know, as law enforcement officers would have upheld. And Rick gets popped back in, and he's still, you know, back on the page the day he got shot, where, you know, getting shot's bad, but at the same time, you wouldn't necessarily turn around and empty your gun into someone's head over it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not so much he's clinging to his humanity, it's more a case of, no, I've missed three chapters out of the book kind of thing, and I don't know what's going on.
You can kind of empathise with Rick in this scenario. But no, I do feel like he's still part of the old world in a way that Shane isn't.
Yeah, that's probably fair. But, I mean, you have to ask yourself, why have none of the other characters, not even Daryl, really gone the same way as Shane? Not so quickly. They all get hardened to things. And they all become much tougher as they get up. I mean, to start with, it's like one zombie is like, everybody screams.
Yeah,
and a couple of seasons in, it's like one zomp, and it's like, yeah, okay, just come a bit closer, and I'll stab you in the head.
If she just stab, and that's it. That's so chill.
And you see them running from packs of zombies in the first one, and then a few seasons on, it's like, well, there are only five of us, and there looks like there's about 400 zombies, so we can totally win this, guys. Back to back, everyone knife in each hand, kind of thing. They're not bothering with guns anymore.
Well, yeah, why should they? It's waste of ammunition. So they can use the knives.
There's obviously character development, but Shane has gone from A to Z really, really quickly.
Yeah.
Even with all the stimulus, as it were. Which makes me think that there must be something there already.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you. He definitely had the temperament whereby he was actually suited to that world, whereas the others had to kind of make it.
Yes, they'd survived by, you know, creating new conditioning for themselves, new programming.
Yeah, but again, I think the fact is that, yes, even though you did have Rick entering into this world very, very suddenly, he adapted to it quite quickly. And to be honest, everyone else was still adapting too.
Yes, they were. Compare and contrast with the whole sort of being taken down into a fairy mound and finding out that the world's gone past by 100 years when you come back. I think what was most disquieting about those fairy tales was that they always stopped when the person who'd been abducted by the fairies came back and found out that so much time had passed and everyone they knew was dead. and then you never found out what happened to them. It's like, well, did all the villagers turn round and stone them to death? What happened, you know?
Are they okay? Please.
Did they adjust to the new time? Were they constantly out of step with everyone else? I mean, if you think about it, if you took somebody... Okay, theoretically, you're a fairy, Madeline, and you have a fairy mound, which is
theoretically
awesome. And full of music. Yeah, theoretically. We don't want anyone to know the truth. And you find a likely young man who plays the bagpipes, and you lure him down to your lair.
Yes, casually.
And then when you let him go, because, you know, being a fairy queen, you're just a bit callous about humanity and everything.
Yeah, whatever.
You're not bothered about the time difference. And you release him back into the wild. You've taken him down, say, in 1910. So that's great. He's missed both world wars. But he arrives back in 2010 and doesn't know what an iPhone is.
Or, yeah.
You know, computers. And you just think of all the things that have happened in the last 100 years. And I know we're going faster now, but don't say if you abducted someone in the 1700s and they returned in the 1800s. But even so.
It definitely would be a culture shock.
I mean, I don't know. Some people, possibly, they might just snap under the stress, I think.
Yeah.
As a thought experiment, I mean.
That makes it just sound like
you're actually trying to do a human time capsule. It sounds a bit like I actually want to try this. I don't.
Yeah,
I don't think I'm going to live for 100 years for a start.
Well, you don't know.
Oh, God.
Sorry, that came off terrifying.
That sounded like I'm going to curse you with eternal life. You annoyed me this morning.
We've looked at kind of examples of characters waking up in the future. There are some slightly more extreme ones. Actually, it appears in cartoons as well. And for the life of me, I cannot remember it. But I swear there's a cartoon about a guy who gets frozen in ice and... then he sort of unmelts and is in a modern society. There's also Stig in the Mud.
I've never read that. I know it's one of the ones you're supposed to read, but I've never read it.
Oh, fair enough. But yeah, that was a cute little one. But again, it's the bringing of a caveman into sort of modern society. But it does actually work out for him a little bit because the boy he's with, he doesn't actually seem to be that perturbed by everything that happens. He's perturbed. He doesn't understand the way things are and he kind of gets in the way of stuff, but he doesn't seem to actually be, it doesn't get in the way of him. It's not, he's not confused or upset or anything like that. It's not an issue. Whereas for the boy, he kind of accommodates this caveman instead.
Yeah.
It is quite a sweet little thing. I do recommend watching it.
The ones that sort of freak me out that are... okay, there's two examples. One of them is a manga, which I cannot remember the name. I say manga. Do I mean anime? I mean anime. And I saw it as a child, and I've seen it once since then, and I just can't remember the title, but it's a sci-fi one, and you have this family who are operating a huge spacecraft. And they get a distress call from a planet, and there's a little boy on the spacecraft as well, and they go down looking for the person who sent this distress call.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't find any sign of any danger or anything, and so they decide to stop for a little while for a rest, and they have a picnic, and it's a great family day out kind of thing. And then the little boy goes missing, and they can't find him. And, you know, it's dreadful. It then gets really traumatic because they can't find him, and they have to go take off because suddenly there's atmospheric disturbance on the planet. So they take off because otherwise the ship would have been destroyed, but obviously they're still looking for this little boy. And then they pick up the distress call again, and they finally go down to the planet, and they find the person who sent the distress call, and he's an old, old man. So they take him aboard the ship, but they can't get much sense out of him because he's so old, he's not really making much sense, and he's been on his own for such a long time that he's just not socialised anymore. And you get to the end of it.
I have a dark feeling, I know.
Yeah, you get to the end of it, and they... There's this thing that gives him away, and he finally says it, and he says it a few times, this old man, and they realise that it was the little boy, and because the time moves slightly differently on the planet as it would to them on the spaceship, they've only been gone like a year or so, and he's been down there for something like 80 years, this boy by himself. And this is their child. He's like this 80-something-year-old man. And it's just, and then it ends. It's just really traumatic.
Nice way to end it.
And then Star Trek did something similar. Star Trek Deep Space Nine. O'Brien's. Once again, what I'm learning from this is you never go down to a strange planet and take your family for a picnic, because they do the same thing. They take their daughter down onto the planet, and she goes missing in what turns out to be a time cave. I'm pretty sure that's not what they call it. And they can't find her, and they have to go back up to the space station. And then they find a life signal down there, so they go down to get her, and she's a grown woman. And she's been living savage for about 10 years. And, you know, they're trying to reintegrate her as their daughter and everything, but she doesn't really remember them because of things she's had to do to survive. That has a happier ending. She works out, the daughter works out that if she goes back into the cave at the right time, she can send the little girl out, because there's a point in the cave where it's a bit like Schrodinger's box, where both the little girl and the grown adult exist at the same time. So she goes in, sends the little girl out, and then ceases to exist herself. I say it's a happier ending. It's kind of a mixed happier ending.
I mean, they did that kind of in Doctor Who as well. There was a case of with the was it the 12th, the 11th? With Amy, Amelia Pond, where she got left on this sort of island. They went to this special sort of medical kind of facility thing where she was left on there, and she aged in a matter of, for the others, it felt like a matter of, you know, minutes. But for her, she was there stuck for years, and they want to go back and get the young version before she's stuck in there, and the old versions, they're like, well, no. And it was quite complex, because it was, in that case, it wasn't so much a character being taken out of time. It was a bunch of characters meeting someone who was not of their time, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, there's the way they create these. They're almost like bubbles that encapsulate one particular moment.
Yeah.
And while the bubble's moving, what's inside the bubble stays at the same pace as the moment it was captured.
Yeah.
So, yeah, travelling without moving, basically. But yeah, it's really freaky.
I don't like it.
And that's why I think that's part of the reason I always found 12 Monkeys kind of creepy as well. Like, constantly having to go back and repeat the same pattern over and over again.
Yeah. No, it is. It's scary.
We were also going to look at characters who, just for whatever reason, they feel dissociated in their own time. They don't fit in. They feel isolated. They're born out of time. A really good example of this are the two, well, you know, the mirror characters in Lost in Austin, which I'm going to claim is fantasy because she just keeps stepping into the world of Pride and Prejudice.
I don't actually know that.
It's absolutely awesome. I'm going to have to make you sit down and watch all six episodes now.
Okay.
Basically, you've got 21st century woman Amanda, who's, I don't know, about 26, well-paid job, independent, bit of a dick boyfriend, probably isn't good enough for her, but he's not a bad person. Great friendship with people. But she just feels lost. She's not connecting with her own time and people from her own time. What she really wants to do is just sort of stay home and read Pride and Prejudice, because when she wants to escape, that's where she likes to go.
Fair
and
enough,
then she
yeah.
finds a magical door in her bathroom by accident. Her bathroom is obviously in a terraced Victorian house, so this is quite unlikely. But she goes through and finds herself and finds herself at Longbourn with the Bennets. And
do the Bennets know her?
Well, not exactly, but she goes down and turns around and goes, oh, this is absolutely insane, my mind's finally snapped, I have to stop reading that book, kind of thing. But the door won't let her back through. And one of the servants finds her and says, oh, well, here you are, miss, would you like to come down to dinner now? It's been served. So she's like, okay, well, I suppose I better go with them, really. Meanwhile, Elizabeth Bennet has discovered the magic door from the other side and gone through, so there's been a transfer. Because Elizabeth Bennet also, if I mean, if you read her, she's a radical character. Politically, yeah. She's really radical for the time. You can see why that book put a lot of conservative noses out of joint. Because it takes apart the entire system that their wealth and their influence is founded on. And it says, you know what, if you don't want what's happening over in France at the moment to happen here, you need to start embracing the people rather than just living off their labour.
Yeah.
And grinding the poor down into the dust kind of thing. But it was said with quite a bit of delicacy.
Yeah.
So Elizabeth Bennet's obviously someone who feels out of time in, you know, and isolated in her own time. And she fits into 21st century London really well. I mean, they think she's a bit weird to start with and she talks a bit funny, but they're much more accepting of her. Amanda, unfortunately, gets on pretty well with Jane, and she gets on with the younger sisters okay and with Mr. Bennet. Mrs. Bennet doesn't like her very much at all. But she makes all the sorts of gaffes you'd expect someone from the 21st century to make in the 18th century and the early 19th century.
Mm.
There are all sorts of things that even us with our best polished manners on would be considered really coarse and rude and, you know, completely outside the system of courtship and social hierarchy. And a lot of it was so subtle that we, you know, without really studying it, you wouldn't know.
Yeah.
And anyway, it's hilariously funny. She completely upsets the entire timeline and then upsets even more trying to get it all back on track. And she's devastated because she, her entire life has been sort of focused on Lizzie Bennet and Mr. Darcy getting together. You know, it's her one sort of, that's her constant. I won't spoil it. You've kind of got to see it for yourself. But it's an absolute gem, really. And it's really funny. It's just a perfect example of how you can feel completely lost and disconnected in your own time, in your own society, and then through a lot of struggling and making a muddle of things, find out that you can carve out a place for yourself. You've just got to choose the right place.
That is really, really interesting. I have actually read a book like that as well, where it wasn't a young woman who went into in particular Pride and Prejudice, but she just ended up in Regency England. She kind of swapped bodies with someone, and you don't really see the other person. She just sort of possesses this woman's body.
Yeah.
And she finds that this woman has a romance with someone else. And it's not that the character themselves has a romance with this person, though she kind of does. She's trying to figure out herself as well. In the modern day, I think she's broken up with her boyfriend and she can't figure out who she really, really loves or anything like that. And she's obsessed with Pride and Prejudice and Jane Austen. And actually in the book itself, while she's in this Regency period, first of all, she meets Jane Austen, who's and she's like, oh, I love your books. And Jane Austen's there like, how do you know about that I'm the author and stuff like that.
It's like they're by a lady and then by the author of Pride and Prejudice.
it was a bit of an adult fantasy book and sort of a, this really funny scene where a guy kind of solicits her a little bit and she's angry with the gentleman that she's supposed to be kind of with, and he asks her, you know, he's heard that she's quite a liberal person, and so they go off together. You know, they're sort of, things are moving on, and he removes his trousers. But just before he does, she suddenly has this whole think about the fact that, you know, she's really, really ready to get it on. She hasn't had sex in a while, and she really just kind of really wants to. And so she's getting quite excited by this prospect. And then she suddenly has a think about the fact, oh, well, you know, we don't have condoms, and actually I'm inhabiting this woman's body. It's not really my life. If she gets pregnant, that's it for her. If anyone finds out, that's it for her. And actually, I'm angry about this guy for doing something which is totally not the same as what I'm about to do. And in that moment, the guy takes off his trousers and she looks at him and he's incredibly well hung. And she starts laughing maniacally. Because she's just there like, why did I start thinking about this? But of course he completely takes it the wrong way and stuffs himself back into his trousers and is very grumpy about the whole thing. But I really liked the scene. I just thought it was hilarious.
Yeah.
But yeah, I have read those, and it is interesting because I think a lot of people, well, there was the phenomenon of getting Darcy'd after the BBC Pride and Prejudice came out. And obviously Pride and Prejudice as a book and Jane Austen as a writer has influenced and captured the imaginations and the hearts of generations of people. But I think the media caught the attention of a lot of potential new readers who might not necessarily have picked up the books otherwise.
Yeah, basically that 1995 adaptation of Pride and Prejudice with Colin Farrell and Jennifer Ealy started a
Colin
20-year
Farrell.
Colin Farrell. Oh my God, Colin Firth. They've both got F names. Sorry. Basically, it started a 20-year-long obsession with Jane Austen that hasn't waned yet.
Yes. And so I think you get this whole thing about people who feel like, oh, I belong in this era. And they're not thinking I belong in this era. They're thinking I belong in this storyline. It's not about the era. And actually that then births a lot of fantastic fiction where women get the wish, they get to go to that era, and it's actually not like they imagined.
No.
Again, I liked this book because, she was talking about the fact that she kept wanting to have baths. And then she watched the servants having to drag water up every time. She was there like, oh, this is bad.
A bad, bad person. Yeah, and it was largely built off of slavery
Yes.
as well. So when you dig into that, that's all a bit unsavory if you're a 21st century person. And
Yep.
add on to that, if you got married, you were literally risking your life because you had a 1 in 50 chance of dying in childbirth. That's every time you gave birth. On average, you would end up probably giving birth 10 times in your life. On average, some women gave birth as many as 25 times in their lifetime. Not always to living children, but
Yeah.
those are the odds. So getting married was pretty serious business.
It was not always fun either.
Although, a little snippet I did find, up until some prating know-it-all man decided to interfere with things, up until 1814, when a particular law was changed, it wasn't considered infanticide to abort your child. Up until sort of the fourth or fifth month, which was called quickening, when the child could freely be felt moving around inside, how a woman went ahead with her pregnancy or not was entirely her business, and men didn't interfere. You could actually buy pills to get your courses started again if you. Allegedly, if for some woman's complaint, but quite often the woman's complaint was pregnancy,
Yeah.
you could actually buy pills to just get everything moving again, to flush everything out, as it were, from your local library.
The library, I love
Well,
it.
the big chain store chemist Boots started off life as a rotating lending library, which also sold things like Balm of Gilead, which was, a balm you put on your bits for all the sort of things that might go wrong with your bits,
Right.
and and all sorts of sort of cosmetics, creams and potions and things, but generally it was a library.
I love
We forget all this. I mean, it just wasn't. You could. There were adverts in the papers. If you go back to some of the papers from sort of 1757 and onwards, there are adverts for women's pills. It's actually what they're called. And if you look at the list of contents, everything in them is like highly toxic and stuff that you're not supposed to take if you're pregnant. So they were basically saying, you know what, if it's your 10th child and you really don't want to have it, try these kind of thing.
We get you.
Yeah,
We really get you.
they weren't difficult to get hold of, so.
There you go, you learn something new every day. I did not know that.
No, and then someone, well, as I can't remember the name of the bloke, but he was Lord somebody in 1814, said, oh, hang on a minute, let's think about this. When does life begin? And started the whole sort of pro-choice, pro-life argument. But one good thing he did as part of amending the same law was basically if you were an unmarried woman who gave birth to a child and it was stillborn, you were presumed to have murdered the child and then you were generally hanged for it.
I think that's actually still actually a law in there was a recent article about a young woman in, I think, Taiwan, no, the Philippines, I'm not sure, but again, the same law where she had a child that was stillborn and she was jailed for it.
Yeah, you're presumed guilty of infanticide. That used to be the law here up until 1814 as well.
That's crazy.
Yep. Anyway, so there we go. We're clearly out of time again. So going back to our time travelling heroines, obviously I think we have to mention Outlander.
Yes. She has, Claire as a character has got a an advantage because she goes out of time, but she has skills from her present time that are useful for where she is.
Yeah, she has that, and she's also quite a confident person who thinks differently. She's, in some ways, she doesn't fit into her own time, which is the 1940s, very well, because yeah. She's been brought up by this archaeologist uncle who said, okay, don't go to school if you don't want to, follow me around and learn things piecemeal.
Yeah.
So yeah, she's been very well prepared to just not think within the social constructs of her time either.
Yeah. So she, you're right, she doesn't really fit in her timeline at all. And interestingly enough, the place she finds she fits in isn't in the future, but it's in the past.
Yeah.
Now, how much of that is, I wouldn't say she fits in a social way. She gets into all sorts of social trouble, you know. Yeah, she's accused of being a witch and all sorts.
She can't seem to stop herself. And she can't hide the fact that she's very intelligent and very well educated, which is also an issue being a woman in the 18th century.
Yeah. But she does, I think it all lies in the fact that she meets another person who's incredibly liberally minded.
Yeah.
And the fact that she's actually older than Jamie in the books, is she not?
Yeah, a significant bit. I think he's sort of 21, she's 26, 27, which, you know, would almost make her middle-aged for a woman at the time.
Yeah.
You know, we think nothing of it now. Whereas he would be considered a very young man, sort of just out of boyhood. But that age difference, even now, if it you have a younger man and an older woman, that's quite significant.
Yeah.
In terms of mindset. It's not insurmountable or anything, but, you know, it's very definite, sort of, the woman's got an advantage there, I think.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, of course, the other way around, it wouldn't have been considered the same way.
No, it wouldn't at all.
But, yeah, as she has something over him. I say something over him like she's manipulating him. She isn't. But she can influence him. He's learning stuff in the world, and because of that, he learns from her. So she actually brings him into her world, and he kind of fits there because he loves her.
Yeah, it's a partnership of equals that you perhaps wouldn't get if it was the other way around, because she's very much, she knows her own mind, and she's just come through the Second World War as a combat nurse.
Yeah.
So she's seen things, you know. That's the sort of understanding that would be very rare to have with your wife in the 18th century.
Yeah. No, it is a really, the way that Outlander is done is quite interesting, because it's not just erotica.
No. Of course, the other thing that I do actually want to mention is she might quite like Jamie in a casual sense initially, but mm-hmm. they're married before they really fall for each other.
Yeah.
And that's a position where she really isn't given very much choice. It's a case of, will you marry him, or we'll assume you're a spy and we'll torture information that you don't have out of you. And
yeah.
Claire's a survivor. It's like, okay, well, I'm still married to my husband, but he hasn't been born yet and won't be born for 200 years. So technically, you know what, I'm just going to have to marry this person and sleep with them and get away when I can. She's very practical about it, particularly in the books.
Yeah, and I really do admire her. I mean, you can't fault her logic.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I've got far more chance of getting back to Frank if I do this and do it all willingly than I have if I put up a big fight.
Yeah. So that is an interesting one, because she's not necessarily looking for a way out. She's looking for something, but she's not pining away thinking, I don't live in this time. Interestingly enough, though, another character that you meet on the show, and I don't know whether she appears in the books, is the Scottish woman who comes from even further in the future than Claire does.
Gaelis Duncan.
That's right.
She's called something else when she's in the 1960s, where she's a lecturer on social freedom and is trying to sort of get the Jacobites up and running again.
Yeah, and she wanted to come back. She's there for a purpose. She's there for a reason.
Yeah, it was very definitely planned.
So that, again, is someone who was out of time. And we don't really get to see anything from her perspective, which is a shame, because an interesting character, to be sure.
You get a lot more from her later on in the series. In the books, I mean.
You mean before she's killed?
Ah, well, think about it. We don't ever see her killed, do we, in the first two books?
Ah, spoilers.
So, I'm sorry, but I think most people probably worked that one out. She was allowed to live until she gave birth. It'd be quite easy to smuggle her out then.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay. So, moving now from that, I feel I want to mention another Japanese anime called Inuyasha. And Inuyasha is, and I think I've mentioned it before on the show, Inuyasha is about a girl named Kagome who falls through a magic well that takes her into feudal Japan.
Cool. Well, theoretically cool, but the more you read about feudal Japan, actually, it's not that cool at all.
Yeah, but this is a feudal Japan which is filled with yokai, demons and stuff like that. And she finds out that she's the reincarnation of a great priestess called Kikyo, who sealed a half-demon called Inuyasha to a tree. The two of them were in love with one another, and then they betrayed each other, and he killed her, and she sealed him into a tree before she died.
As you do.
As you do. And Kagome comes back, and with her she brings something called the Shikon no Tama, which is highly coveted by all the demons, and so all the conflict starts because she arrives, and she also releases Inuyasha. She's just ticking all the boxes. And ultimately, it's very early on you realise that a romance between Kagome and Inuyasha is inevitable, even though it does cause conflict, of course, because she's not actually Kikyo. He was in love with Kikyo, but then he likes Kagome, and it gets complicated. Yeah. And then Kikyo also returns, so it's even more complicated. So it's, when I say it's historical, you know, it's very, very light. She might as well have fallen into a fantasy world. But that being said, there are, when she goes back to the present, the yokai still exist in a certain respect, and spooky supernatural stuff still does happen. Now, skipping to the end, and this is a spoiler, she is given the choice, once her mission is complete and everything is done, she's given the choice of whether she stays in feudal Japan or she goes back to modern Japan. And she ends up in modern Japan for a few years, and she graduates, and the well stops working. She can't really sort of pass through it anymore.
Yeah.
And after she's graduated and she's gone through it all and she's aged a little bit, she goes back to the well and she just thinks about the fact that she actually kind of wants to go, you know, she's reminiscing. And the well opens up and there's this sense that you get that this is the last time, this is her chance. And her last chance, even though that's never explicitly stated.
No.
And yeah, she makes the choice that despite the fact that she's a very modern girl, and she's always bringing back modern things into the past, like with no sense of consequence at all. So it's just like she has a bicycle there that gets destroyed all the time. And for some reason, she's always there wearing her school uniform, which I'm never entirely sure about. Which just seems incredibly impractical.
How are they like not picking up on that?
Yeah. Anyway, so I mean, I guess this is a world full of demons, so everyone's a bit distracted. But yeah. So, and she like her friends are constantly eating all the modern food she brings, and they're all obsessed with pot ramen and stuff like that. But yeah, she despite the fact that she is clearly a very modern girl, she goes back because actually she's built a life for herself there in a way. And the end is her, she returns and she starts to learn to live in that era. And I liked it. It's a fantastic series anyway. I do highly recommend it. It's really good. It's very sweet. But I liked it as well because she wasn't pining for something else. She was actually happy with the way she was living. This is something that originally she didn't really want, but the way she grew as a person, the relationships she created whilst on these adventures, she became an adult in that world. And that's the world that she chose to live in.
Yeah.
It's also because there is, you know, that may mean that she's her own great 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 etc. grandmother.
Predestination time paradox.
But yeah, it is interesting, and I really liked the concept of it. But yeah, someone being placed out of time. We then have, if we remove the time element, then we have another similar anime, which is again also based on a manga called Kyokara Mao, which is about a boy named Yuri who gets flushed down a toilet. Don't ask.
It's anime. I'm not surprised by anything anymore.
Yeah, no, he gets dunked after stopping a bunch of bullies trying to hurt someone. And so they dunk him instead, and he gets sucked down into this medieval alternative world, which is run by demons. And they're like, "You're our king." And he's like, "I'm what now?" he's placed on the throne and he's the demon king. And I really, really liked it as well, because it starts off with him just in sort of total denial, like, this is a very interactive medieval sports thing or something. Entertainment. But again, he fits, and it's this sense of, actually, this is where I belong.
Yeah.
And he kind of starts to make changes and challenges, and it's the fact he has a perspective from outside of the kingdom that allows him to make judgments which none of the others can, because they've been brought up with prejudice, and they've been brought up only seeing things in one way, because they're not an unkind people, but they are, you know, they can only see within the box. So I quite like that. I quite like it when you get the outsider comes in and they're totally displaced, but it's because they're displaced that they can actually resolve issues that couldn't otherwise have been resolved.
Yeah. Talking about outsiders, I've recently finished reading The Chronicles of St. Mary's, and, you know, my life is now over because I need the next book. It's nine books long, and I just mainlined them in about a week and a half. And that's an audiobook as well. It's by Jodie Taylor, and it's about a group of time-travelling historians who go back to record exactly what happened during history.
Yeah. And
it's told from the perspective of Dr. Madeleine Maxwell, who...
Good name.
Yep, exactly. Better known as Max, because she's trying to distance herself from her extremely unhappy and rather confronting childhood. So she goes by the name Max, or, you know, later to her significant other, Lucy. There's a whole riff about why he calls her that. And it's utterly amazing. She doesn't fit in because she sort of refuses to quit in life in general. I mean, she's sent off to these girls' schools and things, and she gets expelled something like 3 times, and she's always in trouble because she has a real problem with authority. But the thing she really likes is history. She loves history. And a teacher manages to get to take her in hand and offers her a last chance. And then years later, this same teacher writes to her after she's got her advanced doctorate and says, "You know what, I know this is perhaps not the pay grade you're looking for, but you need to go along. I've arranged a job interview for you, and I really think you'd be perfect for it." So she goes along to St. Mary's Priory, which is a big old house, which houses the St. Mary's team. And when she finally goes into the interview, she's surprised to be confronted with this statute of secrecy type thing, the official Secrets Act that she has to sign, and loads of other paperwork before they'll even interview her.
Wow.
And of course, when she finds out what it is, she's like, no, I need this job kind of thing. And, you know, it has horrible bits, but it's so funny. It's really, really funny. And she never really ever fits in, but she fits in with the team of people at St. Mary's because it's one of those places where you really do have to be a bit nuts to work there.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, she's utterly badass. I think in the first book, there's a point where she is holding off a T-Rex from two of her companions using pepper spray, harsh language, and a stern glare. And somehow she makes it work. Everybody should read these books. They're absolutely awesome.
I will definitely have to check that out. You brought up something interesting there, which was the creating of a new environment. Because you're the where the place you're out of time is and is your own place, is your own reality. And so you create somewhere where you do fit in.
Yeah, it is literally carving out your own little niche, finding your family, finding your people. And that does feed into a previous subject where we were talking about found families and tribes.
I think we're running out of time, but before we do, I just want to mention a book that I'm currently reading, which I'm sure you've read, Jules.
Okay, you're gonna have to tell me what it is.
No, guess. It's The Night Circus by Erin Morgenstern.
Yes.
And I'm only halfway through it. I'm really enjoying it. It's very, very unique. But it does bring to mind again that the creation of a place where you belong.
Yeah.
And this kind of this prevailing feeling that circuses and things along those lines are places where misfits or people from outside can gather in a safe environment where they all belong. And in particular, this is a great book because even the characters who before we even get to the circus, it starts off with these two orphans, and neither of them really belong. They are misplaced. They don't ever have a place. One of them doesn't even have a name. The other one has a name which her father is constantly trying to change. And I really like that because there's this sense of misplacement in one's own body
Yeah.
that they don't actually have autonomy over their own body, they over themselves, over their choices, over their future. They are just left floating without any real answers and without being able to step forward or move back or make their own choices, which creates a very disrupted feeling within me. I feel quite harrowed, to be
Yeah,
honest.
I know what you mean.
So I am wondering whether they'll turn the tables a little bit later on, and I won't ask you to tell me, but whether, they will be able to create for themselves their own kind of path and their own carve their own place
Yeah.
within their own lives, if that
Yeah,
makes sense.
I know what you mean. Yeah, that's a great book.
It is. It's very enjoyable, very interesting read. A unique narrative. You know how I hate present tense.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan, but you
Yeah,
sort of forget it's in present tense, don't you?
it is. It's I've never been able to finish a book that's in present tense, but I do think I will be able to finish The Night Circus because it's actually done in a very efficient way. So, kudos to that. I don't like present tense, but this one is working for me. So yes, tell us, listeners, if have you ever felt out of time? I guess I should ask you first, Jules. Have you ever felt like you're out of time, that you belong somewhere else?
Yes, but I couldn't tell you where that is, to be quite honest. I think it's more a case of I've always been a bit too weird to fit in, I think is the best way of putting it.
Yeah.
And I have the unfortunate habit of saying what I'm thinking as well, which obviously doesn't win you very many friends. What about you?
Well, you can read Kestrel Saga and that's your answer. I think I belong in that world. I definitely would. I'm not one of these people. I would love to visit the past. I would not like to live in the past. I'm fond of modern medicine and comforts and things like that in general. In fact, my next series, I think I've mentioned before, with the dragons, it does involve someone being dropped into another world, and they spend a significant amount of time complaining about the fact that there's no air conditioning, which I think would be something I would complain about. So on that note, do tell us, have you ever felt like you've been out of time? Which world do you feel like you really belong in, if not this one? And have you read any books which have got the same themes as the ones we've discussed today? Leave us a comment and thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.